5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
And we're back with another episode of Keep It. I am Ira Madison III, culture writer at The Daily Beast, and I'm joined once again by Kara Brown.
Oh, hey. We're here again.
Yeah. Are you so excited? It's Black History Month. Lewis is not here.
Oh, yeah. Lewis is not here. We've replaced Lewis with the King of Wakanda.
T'Challa, Chadwick Boseman himself, is here.
Yeah.
But he stepped out to get some vegan food.
He did.
So I guess, Lewis, if you're over there in the corner, you
can
join us.
Get rid of me. I'm white and dewy as a Nick Nolte mugshot, and I'm here. Love me.
Actually, it's a good thing you are here this week, because
finally
we have a white person that we need you to explain to us.
Oh,
please.
I'm all ears.
Justin Timberlake again.
I think I've represented that I'm not a very good diplomat on behalf of Mr. Timberlake.
I'm tired of talking about him.
It's been a lot.
I feel like it's been every episode.
Yeah.
However, his album's out, Man of the Woods.
Mm-hmm.
Critics dragged it. The Super Bowl happened. No one liked it except Nikki Haley. And we're going to talk about him one last time, and then we're going to put him in pop music sarcophagus.
Nice.
Which will be beautiful.
Will it?
Yes. Sarcophaguses are lovely.
All right.
I could sleep in one, I would.
Let's get him in there.
The album, before we get into the Super Bowl.
Yes.
Who listened to it?
Mysteriously, I did. I have to say, even though we're familiar with the album titles of Justin Timberlake's album, you know, Future Sex, Love, Sounds, and 2020 Experience, I would never call him an album artist. I don't think we look back on his work and think like, oh, he really, you know, he's like Kanye West or something, you know, or Bjork or someone who really cares about that format. He's definitely singles all the way. And this time, the issue is there's the same amount of filler there always is on his albums, except the singles also aren't that good.
Right.
So it just feels, you know,
also,
like a palette album.
It was 16... tracks.
It's 16 long. Fucking tracks.
It's the like, miseducation of like, Justin Timberlake, okay?
Guys, Thriller was 9 songs and he got the job done.
It reminds me, actually, I was spending I'm doing this sort of writing challenge that these people asked on Twitter, where you listen to an album every day in February that you haven't listened to before and you just like tweet about it. And I was listening to a bunch of albums from like 97 where every hip hop album had 29 tracks on it.
And 6 interludes.
Yeah. And this feels like that.
Because Jessica Biel interludes.
Yeah. I don't know why she's on here.
Wait,
first
is that
of
Jessica Biel in those interludes?
It sounds like
an Oil of Olay commercial.
No, I think it's her.
First of all, I thought it was her popping up on a song, but it was Alicia Keys.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know why she's on the album.
The other thing about the album, which made me irate when he calls it Man in the Woods and he's in his flannel and he's, you know.
He has a song called Flannel.
He has a song called Flannel. And then the first song has a music video with a dancing robot. And I was like, sir, that's not a lot of synergy between the two themes that you were presenting to me. The whole album sounds like he's singing about kind of like folksy Americana shit, but then with like a weird Timbaland beat.
Right. I think ultimately it doesn't sound enough like a departure. It doesn't sound, folksy is the word you just picked. It sounds still ultimately like the last few albums he's done, while insisting that he's at his cabin.
It's like, if you were going to give us what you gave us before, you brought Timbaland in, you brought Pharrell in, cool, give us those tracks. Or give us your, like, half country, folksy Americana shit. Like, just pick one. And I actually think that would have been more successful for him. I think it would have still been irritating if he had completely switched lanes and, you know, given us like a Miley Cyrus album. But
well, what's weird too is that it seems to work when he makes his songs with Chris Stapleton. I like it.
Did you?
Well, I feel like maybe because Chris Stapleton seems like a real artist.
Right.
And he makes good country songs. So when Timberlake has always been a chameleon, he could slip into black culture just as easily as he could slip back into, you know, the honky tonk. And
I think, denim fedora.
Yeah, you know, and when he's with Chris, like, I like that Say Something song. And I like the song that they did before, like the Drink You Away or whatever. And if he wanted to make a whole album of that, sure. But then your singles are like Filthy, which the lyrics sound like a dirty knockoff because he's talking about, like, we're not leaving the club till 6 a.m. I'm like, first of all, your old ass is not in the club till 6 a.m. You were at Oh Fudge.
Right.
With Jessica Biel.
He should have made
not paying her workers.
He should have made a dad album and, like, been like, I'm like a country dad now and I wear my denim shirts. And he's been like, and then that would have been like, okay, sure, fine.
Kind of like if you remember his contributions to the Inside Llewyn Davis soundtrack, which was like really like Peter, Paul, and Mary or something.
Do but we it's like, remember his what to the what?
You have to believe me on this.
Okay.
He was in
First
a movie.
Of all, Inside Llewyn Davis is a great movie. It's a Coen Brothers movie.
Oscar Isaac maybe at his hottest.
It stars Oscar Isaac, and he's very hot in it, but the Oscars ignored it.
Okay, keep going.
I have to say, I think the least successful part of the album also is he's just done the robo noises before. It's like you've already had all these albums that sound like somebody turning on a printer. You know what I mean? We don't need this again in 2018.
So we weren't the only ones who were confused by the album. It was pretty much universally dragged. And going into the Super Bowl, he was doing the halftime show, and here you are dropping an album 2 days before it that nobody wants. And now here's a halftime performance that he didn't even seem to want. I was ready for a fun Super Bowl show because, to be honest, I've seen Justin in concert twice, and I've seen NSYNC in concert once, and he was always fun. Like, he's a good dancer. He always leaned into the spectacle, at least with his NSYNC days and with the Future Sex Love show. And whenever you remember his VMA performances, they always had something going on that felt like, oh, cool, this could translate to the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
And then you see his halftime show, and he's dressed in a tie-dyed suit like he's a Molly dealer at Coachella. And he just has
that.
He
just has like a camo.
Yeah.
It was a weird camo.
The shirt was the craziest part with like the deer on it. Like it looked like a mural in a dentist's office.
He's wearing J's.
Right. So we could remember
that he knows a black person. And then there was like Gap employees dancing around him. The whole thing looked like thrown together in a week.
Lazy. It was lazy. And the other, you know, people were saying before that there was no way he could win because, like, people had already kind of were at the end of their rope with him. The album sucked. And people were like, you guys weren't going to like the performance, whatever, which is not true. Because, like you said, like, he has hits. He has lots of jams. If he had come in with some energy, if he had brought in a guest, which was crazy to me that we just had to watch just him the whole time, and if he had actually looked like he gave a shit about being there, I think we all would have given him his props.
I think also he was disadvantaged slightly, though, by the fact that 4 or 5 years ago, he won the Video Vanguard Award at the MTV Video Music Awards, where he did a really long and awesome medley of all his hits. And it was also just a better directed version of what he did at the Super Bowl. Everything got a moment. Senorita got a moment. You had the actual NSYNC reunion. So this, to me, felt like an abridged version of that with the Prince edition, which, here's the thing. It's like, I don't mind, like, a toast to Prince. This is my deeply unpopular opinion. Everything on Purple Rain is super overplayed and I don't need to hear it again.
Woo!
If he had done like You Got the Look or something, which to me feels more in line with his music, it would have been a little bit more interesting.
No, listen, I have long believed that Purple Rain is great, but we all know it.
Yeah, right.
And if you're going to be doing Prince tributes, which it
seems like... In Minnesota.
In Minnesota, give us something different.
Yeah, like Soft and Wet, like some of like the, or like Erotic City or something.
It's like
that.
When Madonna did the Prince tribute and sang Purple Rain. It's like,
yeah, she sang Nothing Compares to
Nothing
You.
Compares to You. It's like, first of all, you can't even sing the Evita soundtrack. All
right,
anymore.
Don't even start with this Madonna shade.
Try singing Crazy for You, and then you can go sing a Prince song. But it was like, you're Madonna, and when I go see you, I want to hear you, you know, sing like Borderline, and I want to hear you sing Music and, you know, Beautiful Stranger. So why aren't you singing an upbeat Prince song?
Yeah.
And we know what you are, Justin. So why didn't you give us like Raspberry Beret or something?
That would have been cute. Raspberry Beret would have
Purple
been
Rain
really
is not your
choice.
Lane. Yeah.
Also, I'll say I don't really need him to be singing it. Like, I get that that's the point of a tribute, but honestly, you should have just played the song and danced around, let Prince sing the song, and moved on with it.
Or had like Sheila E. there to do it too. I know they had
literally
some words.
He should have had he should have had literally anyone else show up with him to that show.
B.B. Mac, Mandy Moore,
90 Degrees. Where were they?
I have to throw it to my friend. He would have redeemed himself, I think, if he was like, ladies and gentlemen, the Backstreet Boys. That would have been pretty awesome.
I thought Britney might come out for a second. I don't know.
You were so naive, Kara.
I know, just because he needed something.
And so here's my thing about Justin. It's so weird for him to be in this pop space right now, because he's sort of been this sort of like lackadaisical, careless white guy for his whole career. And that's just not the cultural climate that we're in right now. And he doesn't fit in the weird way that Taylor Swift, when she came out with her album, didn't fit. Yeah. You know, at least she still is younger and newer. And so, like, she still has her, like, young, adoring fans who are going to propel her album to the top. And she'll sell out her Reputation tour still. But all of her music, it felt like it didn't really belong in this period we're in now. And Justin feels like that now too. It's very weird. And now that he's out here and sort of being careless, people are finally starting to be like, hey, you know what, you used to do stuff that was like fucked up and no one called you out on it, mostly because, you know, black people didn't have that kind of voice that they do on social media right now. You know, if the Janet Jackson thing in 2004 happened now, he wouldn't have a career anymore.
No.
Like, he would have been equally dragged the way that she was. Right. Or the fact that I went through this Twitter thread the other night that had receipts on every interview he used to give during his solo career, where he loved to make a point of bringing up, like, the fact that he went down on Britney Spears or that he would have sex with her all the time.
He, and like, this got carried away in interviews.
And this was
yes.
during that weird period, too, where, like, when they were dating, they were supposed to be, like, saving their virginity for marriage, you know? And we know that they didn't after a while, but, like, he made a point of every interview he was in talking about his sex life with Britney. Like, that's shit that he should have been called out on before.
Yeah, his whole sort of, like, the bro thing doesn't really work as much anymore. I think what you said about the lackadaisical nature of the way he sort of moves through things, it's like, you don't get to act that way when, like, Bruno Mars is out here, like, hopped up for 3 hours a show. When you see the way Beyonce, the energy she brings on stage, even like J-Lo, like, that bitch is dancing her ass off when she's on stage.
Where's
when he comes,
J-Lo's Super Bowl
she
performer?
She should have been the Super Bowl performer, for real.
I will say about his performance, though, it's not like he didn't dance well. It felt slightly off to me. And also, he was singing the entire time. Look, I'm like the Madonna stan of all time, but we all know she wasn't singing during that Super Bowl in which she was dancing. You know what I mean? So I thought he gave
singing.
It an effort. It just didn't
Her
like
track
click.
From 1983 was singing.
Loving. It was beautiful. Yes.
Someone on Twitter also tried to come for me and say, what were you expecting him to do? Like, Bruce Springsteen just stood there and sang. And I was like, first of all, don't ever in your life compare Justin Timberlake to The Boss.
Also, he doesn't dance.
Yes. Justin Timberlake was in a boy band. What were you expecting? Bruce Springsteen to come out
in
and,
the
like,
choreo?
And start pop locking? Also, Bruce has...
Is he plays an instrument?
He also has a whole bunch of fucking albums that Timbaland and Pharrell didn't write for him.
Yeah,
so
right.
They're in a different lane.
That is a wild.
They're just
that's
comparison.
A crazy.
I just
comparison.
Feel like there's so many people trying to make excuses for Justin when it's like, give it up.
like I said, he could have just been better. And I really think it's not like America won't forgive a rich white man. Like, if he had showed up and showed out, people would have been like,
I'm
cool,
sure,
thank you for the show. You're probably forgiven.
I'm sure Richard Branson has killed people, but I still love Flying Branson.
That's right. They're also, just with this album, I can't even really think of what song he's going to release that's going to be the hit single. But mind you, I'll also say this. When Kesha released Praying, I didn't think that would be a banger at all. And now I've heard it 50,000 times. I'm like, oh, what a great pop song. So I feel like I can be brainwashed into liking anything. So I'm worried for Justin Timberlake actually sneaking in with a hit somewhere.
He probably will.
Well, now I'm going to start playing Rita Ora on our car rides to the studio.
Oh, please. I just heard her performance of, what were we watching? Anywhere? Oh my God, what a great song.
She's good.
Yeah. Is this the first time have you gone this long into the podcast? Is this the first time you mentioned her?
Maybe.
Because it's incredible that it took you this long.
Wow. Okay.
You know it is.
I feel attacked.
And also read correctly.
We're closing the book on Justin Timberlake. I don't want to discuss him again.
Can I ask one essay question about him before we move on?
Yes.
The album title, Future Sex Love Sounds, do you think he named it that because he was copying Outkast's Speaker Box The Love Below? Like, he thought that sounded cool, but he didn't realize that was two albums?
Speaking of Outkast, I feel like Bruno Mars low-key shaded Justin Timberlake because he tweeted, next year the Super Bowl is in Atlanta. We got to celebrate by bringing some real hip-hop artists out. We got to do a real show.
He did like a whole list.
A whole list of people saying, let me curate it. And
wow. He's like, less of this Vanilla Ice nonsense.
And you know the NFL is not going to bring those black people on stage.
Jermaine Dupri, I was like, you know they ain't lynching Jermaine Dupri. I'd be happy with it, but you know, they're not rolling up to that.
No, they don't even
care
about.
He's not their first offer, shall we say.
The NFL doesn't even care about the black people that play their game. Right. They don't want them actually performing during the halftime show.
I saw my friend Collier tweeted during the Super Bowl, which I thought was interesting. She said, I wonder if they wanted to make sure that no one who performed at the Super Bowl would protest or kneel. And you had like Pink and then you had Justin Timberlake. And it's interesting because like if, you know, a Kendrick Lamar had performed, it's hard to believe that he would have gone the whole performance without making some sort of political statement, or like the way Beyonce rolled up as a Black Panther last year. And I thought that was an interesting observation.
Well, also, if you recall, Jay-Z was one of the first people they were talking to about doing the halftime show. And he turned it down, reportedly, you know, probably because Jay-Z supports Colin Kaepernick and the kneeling situation.
He 100% does.
And, you know, if we're going to finally get closing that Justin Timberlake sarcophagus, he's done. The Super Bowl happened, and there was an entire year of political discourse about players kneeling, Trump blasting the NFL, and here we go at the biggest football event of the year, and nothing happened.
Yeah. I mean, there are a bunch of, I don't know everyone's names because, please.
Imagine remembering those people. I can't see them. They're wearing helmets.
But
what's their motivation? I can't read it in their eyes.
There were a bunch of players on Philadelphia who throughout the season did kneel and supported Colin Kaepernick. And you've already had some players who were like, I'm obviously not rolling up to the White House to meet that troll. I mean, you look at the way that Colin Kaepernick was blackballed this year and just completely thrown to the wolves. And imagine if one of these players who was not Colin Kaepernick, I can imagine them thinking, if I do this during the Super Bowl, the blowback would be something that they can't overcome. And like Colin Kaepernick doesn't have a job. You can't say that it didn't necessarily work in his favor in that regard. And so I can understand a player who is not him saying like it doesn't feel worth it.
I'm going to say also, it's not just that there would be blowback, but the blowback would be so unpredictable. It's so hard to tell, like, what standing up in a situation like that is going to do to you. Like, it's just like, I almost can't imagine a situation where it's like, and it all completely worked out for me when I spoke up during the Super Bowl.
Right.
You know?
Right, because there's also the thing that, like, not every player who kneels gets to hang out with Ava DuVernay.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. She doesn't have that much time.
Which is also not the.
She's making 700 movies this year.
It's also not the point of a protest is not to become famous.
But the thing is, you know, there's a lot of talk about sacrifice and giving up things. And Colin Kaepernick definitely lost being able to play football by standing up. But on the flip side, he has been able to maneuver himself into a different space within culture where he can still raise money for people. He's still getting magazine covers. He's at the time 100.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just saying that other players who kneel, if they get fired, they can't parlay that into
right.
that. A lot of them just won't have the skills to do some of that.
Colin Kaepernick, people don't necessarily know, but like he spent a lot of time before he decided to protest learning about injustice. He learned about other social activists. He like studied all of this. So he comes in with a lot of knowledge. And right, not every player said, I'm going to take a crash course in Black history and in resistance and use those tools moving forward when I'm going to protest.
Didn't even watch the Eyes on the Prize documentary. I mean, it's only 6 hours.
I mean, People versus OJ? You could have peeped that real quick. But like you said, not everyone could have done what he has done. And I would have loved to see someone kneel during the Super Bowl just to continue to piss everyone off.
Well, don't worry. There was a voice of outrage, and it was afterwards when the Phillies won, and then everything was destroyed by people outside.
Yeah. There was the thing about no one kneeling, and then all of a sudden the Eagles won, and
white people went wild.
They went rambunctious. And you had Trump out here boasting about the fact that nobody kneeled, and yet here he is ignoring this American carnage in Philadelphia. It's worse than Chicago.
Can I just say the
people
idea
in Chicago don't shoot people and then eat horse poop, which there were videos of people doing in Philadelphia.
Right. White people.
And again, it's because they won. I am baffled by we've won the game, so now I'm going to destroy things. Like when Viola Davis won an Oscar for Fences, I didn't go and fuck up a storefront. That was me winning, by the way. Winning, in quotes.
Imagine if Gates destroyed Hollywood every time Meryl won an Oscar.
Come on, Kaftan.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
From the Post. I want to get outrageous this year.
The moment we've all been waiting for finally arrived.
And no one has waited for it more than you, so I'm mostly glad for you.
Uma Thurman has spoken.
Yeah.
And as you know, I have been waiting for this on Twitter with my Uma Thurman fan fiction that no one needs to go and read. It's just melodramatic tweets about Uma teasing the fact that she had a story to tell about Harvey Weinstein. And she finally told it. Unfortunately, she told it to Maureen Dowd at the New York Times. And I don't want to criticize Uma, you know, for who she felt comfortable speaking to. But Maureen Dowd...
You can criticize Maureen Dowd for being a ridiculous writer.
She's a ridiculous writer. Okay, first of all, let me give you some backstory on Maureen Dowd before we jump into the story that she told of Uma's. Maureen Dowd got her fame during the Monica Lewinsky scandal. She got a Pulitzer for her writing. In January, when the scandal broke, she was on Monica's side and was afraid that people would turn her, you know, into a nut or a slut by their writing about her. Come February, Maureen Dowd was dragging Lewinsky left and right, calling her fat, talking about how she was eating spaghetti carbonara, talking about how she was scribbling her name, like Monica Lewinsky Rodham Clinton, on notepads, saying that she seemed like she was auditioning for a job at Revlon. Like, she was tearing this girl apart.
We forget how, like, Jay Leno was like a cultural voice. Like, we all adapted to his take during that time. Yes, including her.
So this is the woman that Uma Thurman told the story of how Harvey Weinstein assaulted her in a hotel room, how she told Quentin Tarantino how it was covered up, and how on the set of Kill Bill, she faced extra abuse from Tarantino when he choked her on set, because she gets choked in the film. He choked her himself. He spit on her face himself to make the spit look real in a scene. And then he made her drive a car on a dirt road that she crashed into a palm tree, and she wasn't given the footage for like years, which is, you know, negligence on the part of the producers, on Tarantino, on Weinstein, on everyone involved. So she had all of this stuff to tell, but somehow it came across jumbled and histrionic and melodramatic because Maureen Dowd wrote it.
She's sipping white wine in her, like, beautiful apartment, throwing empty pizza boxes into the fire. Like, are you insane?
I believe the exact quote was, Uma Thurman is vaping tobacco, white wine as she fed empty pizza boxes into the fireplace of her Upper East Side apartment.
Maybe Jackie, what does that have to do with anything?
Maybe Jackie Collins wrote the lead. And then Maureen picked it up from there.
And it's so sad because that was one of the conversations we had when the Aziz story hit, which is how we're talking about the abuse that women face, talking about the Me Too movement, talking about Time's Up. Like, the way you tell these stories is relevant, and you can do a disservice to victims and to the larger movement depending on how you tell the story. And it's why people and journalists, like the usual team at the New York Times who broke the Harvey Weinstein story, it's a team of really talented female journalists who were treating the topic with respect and sensitivity, and also recognize that with these types of issues, you have to be really on point with how you're telling the story, because people are just looking for ways to poke holes in it. And Maureen Dowd clearly did not get that memo.
I'm going to say, it's also not thorough enough. My problem with the Maureen Dowd piece is it brings up exactly what you said. It brings up the car crash. Weinstein is weirdly this negligible part of the piece.
He's barely in it.
And even though that's like the actual, like, you know, crime, I guess. It leaves you with questions. Like, for instance, the thing about spitting on her, Tarantino, on the set of Kill Bill. I'm reading that and I think, well, I'm not a stunt coordinator. I don't know how that works. But then I think, but neither is Quentin Tarantino. So why isn't he having a stunt person do this? Like, how is this the dynamic he has with Uma? I didn't understand. And she doesn't answer that. And so then when Quentin Tarantino responded with the Q&A in Deadline, I'm weirdly needing to read that because it feels like it's leaving things out.
Yes, there's so many conversations that need to be had about Tarantino and Uma and Weinstein that just really weren't delved into. The piece describes the abuse that Thurman got on set, but also doesn't dive into the fact that this was a pattern with him. You know, Diane Kruger talked about the fact that he was the one who actually is strangling her when she's strangled on camera in Inglourious Basterds, because he said that only he could get it right. You know, he's that kind of person who feels like he has to art direct the abuse that the female characters in his films get, which is weird because so many of his films are always touted as these feminist pieces, but they're all just movies where women are like damaged and beaten up and abused.
And then they become
triumphant in the end.
Yeah.
Well, certainly Jennifer Jason Leigh's role
in The Hateful Eight
was the weirdest case of just, we're literally watching this woman get punched in the face for the first 50 minutes and then almost seemingly set up for a redemption only to be not redeemed at all and borderline crucified in front of us, literally.
Then there's Death Proof, where Rose McGowan is killed in a car crash years after he did that to Uma with the car crash on set. So it's like he's sort of reveling in it.
He,
in the way that Woody Allen revels in his, you know, writing these fantasy, I gave you all the clues, snowman movies about old men and young girls.
Yeah, and I think that he's an eccentric director, and I think to him, one of the things people seem to forget is, like, this is still a professional situation. And so he crosses lines where he's crossing professional lines. But he thinks he's like, I'm pushing boundaries with my art. It's like, no, you're just being a bad fucking employer.
Also, audio came out after his interview with Deadline of an old Howard Stern interview where he defended Roman Polanski's raping a 13-year-old girl.
Not a great time for this audio to come out because it is astounding. It is very unreal.
It is wild.
How come Hollywood embraces this madman, this director who raped a 13-year-old?
He didn't rape a 13-year-old. It was statutory rape.
Yeah, all right.
Well, that's not quite the same thing. All
come
right?
on.
Enough said.
It's not statutory rape. You know, he had sex with a minor. All right, that's not rape. To me, when you use the word rape, all right, you're talking about violent, throwing them down. It's like one of the most violent crimes in the world. You can't throw, you know, throwing the word rape around is like throwing the word racist around. All
okay,
right, you know,
okay.
It just doesn't apply to everything that people use it for. All right, you know, he was guilty of having sex with a minor. All right?
That she didn't want to have.
No, that was not the case at all. She wanted to have it.
Well, and
dated,
in the transcripts,
dated the guy,
and she was 13,
and found out. Well, and by the way. We're talking about America's morals. We're not talking about the morals in Europe and everything. Oh. All right.
Wait a second.
More than Europe, more than China.
With a 13-year-old girl, and you're a grown man.
Uh-huh.
You know that that's wrong because
giving her booze and
pills.
I'm not. She was down with it.
Oh, yeah.
Right. He keeps going on about how it's statutory rape because the girl wanted it, and he's talking about European consent laws. It's wild.
And his tone during it on the Howard Stern show is like, but like he's like reasoning with Robin Quivers, who's saying, but she's drugged, but she's 13. And he keeps basically making noises to get her off those facts, which is very, very strange.
I thought he
acquitted himself somewhat nicely in the Deadline article, which, by the way, I was prepared to hate because in the opening paragraph, Mike Fleming Jr., the writer, says lots of narratives get blown up into convenient narratives for this Me Too movement. I was like, wait, so you get to just openly dismiss the Me Too movement because you're writing a Q&A with Tarantino? Disgusting.
Mike Fleming is, I'm like always hesitant to like call out another reporter, but he is literally always jizzing all over his articles when he interviews men like this. The Tarantino one, he talks about, you know, people are creating these convenient narratives during Me Too and he wants to get the real story out. He was practically salivating when he got the quote-unquote exclusive that Casey Affleck wasn't going to be at the Oscars this year, that he was turning it down. Like, he's awful.
Yeah, he has the same vibe as Tarantino in that Howard Stern interview, which is like, I know people are making a lot of noise about this thing right now, but just listen to me. I'm real.
This wouldn't fly at Deadline under Nikki.
Quite.
Where's Nikki Fink?
Where's Nelly Andreeva just being like, no, I'm in charge of this now. I'm the Rose Byrne and Damages. I will be taking over.
So Tarantino is also supposed to be directing a Star Trek movie, but I feel like that's off the table now.
Like, have you just assume because of all of the press?
But, I mean, this audio is crazy.
But you know, the thing about him, not that I necessarily want things to work out for him, but there's no precedence for this really turning out that badly for him. Like, we've known that he's been kind of a creep. People have had problems with Quentin Tarantino for a while, but his movies were good, and so you sort of overlooked it. So I don't know the precedence for like this not going well for him, because people forgive these dudes and they let them keep making money.
True. And his creepiness hasn't crossed over, as far as we know, into assault.
Sure.
And also, he is at least
sexual assault.
He's at least apologizing here and atoning for behavior. Like, even bringing up exactly, you know,
part of his apology is blaming Maureen Dowd for not including his side of the story, even though he mentions in his alleged apology that they couldn't link up.
Right.
Which, like, so were you not answering her emails? Did you put your phone on silent? Like, you could have been a rebuttal in the Uma story, and he probably just decided, why do that when I can respond on my own in Deadline?
Well, Maureen Dowd is messy, but there's no way the New York Times did not try to get, you know, a statement or confirmation from Quentin Tarantino. That just in and of itself seems
they had they had responses from Weinstein in it.
Yeah.
And we always need to hear him say three more words. So that was
how
exciting.
How is he still talking? Like, the boldness of this man, where it's just every week there's another story of you assaulting some woman and your ass is at some quote unquote rehab sex, whatever the hell. And you are still out here responding to this shit. Shut up. It's over. Just go.
Arizona can be very healing. I have a lot of hope for him.
I mean, but it's the gall of this man to continue to respond to these allegations. I mean, we already know he's a psychopath, but like, if you didn't already realize that, like, this is crazy.
Do you think he picks his responses out of a bowl? Or has he written down every actress that he has assaulted and he just has the response ready if they ever come forward?
Well, I mean, first they've got to not be white. That's the first, you know, because those are really the only, other than Uma.
Yeah.
Those are the only ones he's out here responding to.
Right, because he swiftly denied Lupita
and
Selma Hayek. And he sort of like hedged with Uma in his responses to the New York Times. But then when he started getting dragged, he issued a full response saying she's lying.
I'm hoping there's an actual magic eight ball specific to him that he uses that he shakes up and it says, I could have very well said that, or whatever he said in the Uma article.
That's the treatment at yeah. I'm a dirty creep rehab.
Yeah.
Maybe I said that. That sounds like something I could have said.
When we're back, keep it. And we're back with my favorite segment of the week. It's Keep It. What are we saying no thanks to? What are we tired of? Lewis, you first.
All right, this is a weird one this week. So I apologize if I'm going out on a limb here. But over the weekend, it was the 35th anniversary of the death of my favorite singer ever, Karen Carpenter. Now, if you're not familiar with the Carpenters, they had songs like We've Only Just Begun and Rainy Days and
Lewis,
Mondays.
It's Black History Month.
Okay, well, okay. Well, I'm going to get there.
But
Lewis,
going.
This podcast is being recorded in 2018.
Okay, let me tell you something. I was thinking, Karen Carpenter, greatest vocalist of all time. She must be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. She is not. Then I looked at the record of who gets inaugurated into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame every year. There has never been more than two female performers or female-fronted bands inducted every year, and there's always at least five performers. I just think the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which I'm saying keep it to, was started to commemorate rock as it came of age in the 80s, and since then is basically just here to confirm that the male archetype of a rocker is what's important. That, like, in the history of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, only two women have gotten in their first year of eligibility, Janis Joplin and Madonna. Nobody else has warranted immediate induction. And here's my question. Green Day did get in on their first year. Why is Green Day more important than Whitney Houston, who's not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Why are they more important than Chaka Khan? Why more important, you know, just all these other artists, specifically black women who haven't gotten in yet. Dolly Parton, Cher.
He brought it back to Black History Month.
Black women, how about it?
He saved it.
I just think it's a sexist institution that gets a lot of credit for seeming historic when really they award the same types of people again and again and just undervalue women.
Kind of like the Grammys. So, funny yeah. how that works out.
Kind of like the White House.
kind of like America.
Life. Kind of like life, honey.
Kara.
So my keep it this week goes to Doritos, who announced this week via the CEO of the company, who, by the way, is a woman of color, too. So, girl, I'm looking right at you, that they're working on a chip that is more like female friendly, because apparently women, when they eat Doritos, they don't like to crunch it loudly. They don't like to lick their fingers. They don't like to eat the crumbs in the bag, which is literally the only reason to eat Doritos is for those three reasons. There's no reason to eat Doritos if you're not licking your fingers at the end and knocking back the crumbs. And how did that even, the fact that it made it so far that this woman is giving interviews like, oh yeah, no, we're developing the lady chip, to me is wild. And everyone seems to have lost their goddamn mind.
Also, it's like, are they going for like kitsch humor with Lady Doritos? Because it's just a softer sounding chip. Couldn't they just be like, it's Doritos it be, crackers or
how
something?
How can it be soft and still be a Dorito is also my question. What sort of magic are they applying to the Doritos where it's a softer crunch, but it's still a Dorito?
It's a fruit roll-up.
I mean,
spicy fruit roll-ups.
I don't know what you were doing over there, PepsiCo, which is the company that makes Doritos. But also, people, stop giving us these equal pens and give us the money, please. We'll just take, we will take the money.
Imagine being like mad at a woman for crunching a Dorito. I mean, that must be part of the meeting,
no,
right?
It's like
I can't believe that woman made noise as she chewed a snack. I'm outraged.
So my keep it might be whiter than Lewis's.
Oh, that can't be.
The Arctic Monkeys have a new album
coming out.
I love them. I'm going on record. I love Alex Turner.
Can you love him to be on the show in March?
Okay. Listen, I just want to say that their new album is supposed to be featuring artists like Playboi Carti, Quavo, DJ Khaled, and Gucci Mane.
Oh,
and this is a British rock band who's never had features on their albums, and all of a sudden the new one is this. And maybe I should be celebrating it because it's Black History Month and some rappers are getting a come up, but
it sounds like he's having his Nelly Furtado in 2007 moment where it's like, I'm going to wear a half shirt and dance and Timbaland's going to say it's okay.
So
also, it's not like those rappers need checks. Like, they're doing fine.
Yeah. Fine. My actual Black History Month keep it is the fact that I only saw Black Panther yesterday, and I was not invited to the premiere.
Oh, my God. Leona Hemsley here with her demands. Jesus Christ.
Whoever's responsible, I will find you.
You can probably still make it in, where are they now? They're in Europe now. You could probably still make one of those.
Go to the European premiere?
Text Lupita. When Chadwick comes back, we'll ask him.
I'm picturing you storming up to the gates of Wakanda with your papers, demanding entry.
I'll be at the Black Panther 2 premiere.
I bet you will.
Mark my words.
Invited or not. Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here, Kara.
Oh, you're welcome.
And thank you, Lewis, for showing up when you weren't invited.
That's exactly right. No, I want it to be like the Real World episode where Coral yelled at The Miz for not knowing about Marcus Garvey.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Your future wrestler.
That's actually an incredible Black History Month throwback, and it's not up to me, but maybe you can come back next week just for that.
I think it's allowed.
Earned it,
yeah, you earned it.
Oh my God, you heard it here first, Queens.
All right, I will see you two next week, and when I'm back, an interview with comedian Rhea Butcher. We're talking about Drag Race. So I'm here with Rhea Butcher, comedian. How's it going?
It's going pretty great. How about you?
I am glad you're here.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
I mostly brought you here so you can help me pick my RuPaul's Drag Race Fantasy League.
Okay, great.
I'm glad you love the show.
I do love the show. I will preface this by saying I've only recently jumped in.
When?
like last season, basically. Okay. And then watched a bunch of seasons that are on demand, you know, because the flu has ravaged my household. And so we've caught up on everything. Also, just trying to watch as much queer programming as possible.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, you go through all of Rue, pretty much.
All right. So who are your six?
So my six right now, I have Aja, I have Ben. I can't remember that person's drag name.
Let me see.
The one that is like staggeringly close to Michelle Visage. The
queen.
Yeah.
Ben de la Creme.
Ben de la Creme. Great. Yeah. So I got the name correct.
Yes.
I'm terrified of getting everybody's name wrong. I have Bebe. I have
Bebe Zahara.
Bebe Zahara. Sorry. I said it wrong. Thorgy Thor, Kennedy. And then I have Milk also. Milk is kind of my, like, probably going to get through because good outfits.
Yeah. Milk has really good outfits. Mm-hmm. And I love Bebe Zahara because she's from, like, Cameroon.
Absolutely.
And it's so exciting seeing, like, an African queen on the show.
100%.
So what is it about the show that makes you, like, love it so much?
I mean, I think they really hit, like, a new sort of stride with whatever it is that they're doing. Like, so originally the show was sort of, like, kind of difficult for people, I felt like, because there was, like, a multi-generational thing coming together where, like, an I don't want to say the word old because I don't mean it like that. A previous generation had, you know, a language and an experience that they were bringing to the show. And then a new generation was watching it going, wait a minute, we don't do this anymore. And I think for that reason, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to let the show be the show. And then I think Peppermint was like popping into my feed and I was going like, I have to watch this show.
Yeah, so Peppermint.
I just have to like see this person.
Yeah, Peppermint is a drag queen from New York. And when I used to live in New York, I used to see Peppermint perform all the time at therapy. Yeah. And she came out as trans recently and she became like one of the first trans contestants to get really far in the show. She was in the finals.
And can I ask this question? Because I am not, I don't know this. How many trans contestants were there before Peppermint?
So before that, there were two contestants who came out as trans during the show.
Got it.
So Neek came out during the reunion as trans, and Monica Beverly Hills came out during her elimination episode.
Got it. Okay.
But since then, Carmen Carrera, Gia Gunn, Jiggly Caliente, Jinx Monsoon, Kenya Michaels, and Stacey Lane Matthews have all come out as trans after the show.
There you go.
Which I think is really interesting
if
you think about the concept of just, you know, how the show plays with gender and identity. And it finally, you know, gave these women a place to realize that they were trans or that they were able to come out.
Totally.
You know, by being on the show.
100%. I think that feeling that you're describing, whatever that sort of mix and chemistry of the production of the show and the feeling of the show is what like attracted me to it when I started watching it. And I just love what it's doing, especially now in the like context of the world that we're sort of we've always been living in, but but is the context that more people are aware of. I think the show is just like this amazing, I don't even know the word. It's just like this champion of being yourself, even if it doesn't matter what that is. And I think for me personally, like when I was coming out or figuring things out in my life, which was like, you know, at this point, almost 20 years ago, I went to New York on a field trip with my college, which was in Akron, Ohio. And every year they would go to New York to like go see the art and stuff. And so I went and I had these friends that were gay men and they like got our professor who was very like just a funny woman to go to this drag club and I was absolutely terrified to go in because I was just like afraid that one of these queens would be like, you have a secret and like call me out and they absolutely probably would have and I absolutely probably needed that but I was like so terrified so I feel like now watching it I'm like getting that without the like confrontation of, you know, the actual
physical.
They can't
come through the TV.
They can't do it. Although I would love nothing more than any one of them to be like, you have a secret. It would probably help me so much even now today. But there's just something so like pure about it and layered and concentrated. It's like, it's such a pure queer experience, you know, and I love that. Now they have this fantasy league, which I'm a huge like fantasy baseball player, which I only did last season, but I'm like in love with it because I think I have a low key gambling problem, but it's fine. I don't put any money on it. And like having this fantasy thing, there's like, I don't know, cis dudes on Twitter that I'm friends with that are like playing RuPaul's like drag fantasy. Like, how nuts is that? That people are just like involved in it and into it. You know, like
I played football fantasy league once when I was living in New York because I had a bunch of friends from Seattle and they were really into football. And I had like a year where I sort of pretended I cared.
Sure, yeah.
Then I stopped.
Yeah.
But now the
is
only
that easy.
Yeah. You too can exit a fantasy league whenever you want.
You want.
Now the only one I'm in is Survivor. Because I've watched Survivor since
the whole thing,
the beginning.
All right.
But I am very excited because I love this current season. I'm rooting for. I think I want to pick. You know, Bibi Zahara, because I love an African queen.
Yeah.
I love Shangela.
Yes.
It would be nice if she finally won.
I know.
This
I mean,
her third time
it
back.
Is so many times. I don't have Shangela on my draft. That doesn't mean that I don't love her.
Of course.
Because she also described, like, essentially the way I look at politics on the last episode, which is like, look, we are in agreement that we are all going to do what we want to do and respect each other for that. And I was like, yeah. Yeah, that's exactly how I think about everything. Because they were talking about the like how they were going to kick people off and stuff.
So on RuPaul's Drag Race All-Stars, they eliminate people, not with RuPaul eliminating them. They eliminate people. They eliminate each other.
Yes.
Which like ups the ante.
Oh, 100%.
And it's the,
I love that there's two winners,
yeah,
too.
There's two winners, and they have to lip sync for their legacy. and then they decide which of the bottom two they're going to send home.
Yeah.
Which I think is great, because since you've watched the other seasons,
yes.
One of the biggest parts about being a drag queen, and when you go to see them in bars and see them perform, like, it's all about the lip sync.
Totally.
And that's why I love an All-Stars season, because in the regular season, if a queen is really good and makes it all the way to the end without ever losing and being in the bottom two, you'll never see them lip sync. Which is like last year, Sasha Velour was the winner, and no one really knew what she could do in a lip sync until the finale.
Right. Yeah, you're right.
Which she, I like, feel like is why more people were, you know, sort of like, oh, we really want like a Peppermint to win, because you saw her, you know, at least twice bring it to the stage, and you knew what she could do.
Total, 100%. And also in this situation, they've both already won.
Yeah.
So I almost feel like they're trying even harder than if like they're going to get kicked, because there's like a weird, you know, it like puts you in a weird headspace to have to like lip sync actually for your life. Whereas where you're like, no, I am going to win.
Yeah.
Like you're like winning. I mean, that was like some of the craziest. They both did exactly what they're super good at so well that it was like, how do you pick between these two people?
Yeah.
The, is she going to jump from there? Meme is
the
like
meme.
One of the greatest memes of all time, I think.
I love that we've, you know, kicked off the year with a good meme, and it came from RuPaul's Drag Race.
Right?
It's,
this is what I'm talking about, Ira.
It's Aja. She's performing a lip sync, and she jumps onto this platform, and she starts voguing on the platform, and the other queens are like, is she going to jump from there? And then she literally jumps and does a dip onto the stage, and it's...
And
one
for
of the
a
most
fraction
beautiful
of a second, for a fraction of a second in the slow-mo, you're like, is her hip going to dislocate? Nope, we're good.
She's good.
She's good.
She practiced it.
She practiced it. She did some hip stretches, opened it up.
So RuPaul's Drag Race is so appealing to straight people and everyone on the LGBTQ spectrum. Mm-hmm. What do you think about this show versus, you know, other queer programming is maybe why other queer programming, we don't see it as much, or executives just don't get it. I mean, not that executives get Drag Race, to be honest. I don't think anyone gets it besides VH1 and RuPaul.
Right. I mean, I think for RuPaul, like, we already knew who RuPaul was.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even people that are, you know, like 60 know who
RuPaul
is.
Yeah, I did this documentary on Drag Race for Sundance, and it was just, you know, they were showing clips too, and then I was talking about RuPaul, and I just remember the fact that I knew who RuPaul was
you better work.
Back in the 90s.
Like, as a child in Akron, Ohio, I knew who RuPaul was.
Except that, you know, back then, I didn't have a concept, really, of what
I didn't understand any of it. I was like, okay.
To me, a drag queen could have been trans. Like, you're thinking about that as a kid.
Right.
But yeah, RuPaul's been in the zeitgeist since the 90s. So.
Just forever. And bending the whole thing. Like, I love that she is, I just always use she with RuPaul. I love that she's, in drag, not in drag, like just the whole thing. Like she has like both characters. I also think something that's interesting about this show in particular, and speaking to like the fact that she's been in the zeitgeist and people that are like 60 know her, like she made some joke, like I think I was watching a rerun where she's like, "Who let the hookers in?" And I was like, my grandmother would think that was the funniest joke of all time, because there's something also very like throwback sort of like late 60s, early 70s of like just the sense
of
humor.
Many of the challenges, like one of people's favorite challenge each season is the Snatch Game challenge, which is basically a drag version of like Laugh-In.
Yeah. It's the Match Game thing, which is all those folks on the panel or whatever, and Fanny Flagg.
Yeah.
The famous author of famous lesbian, unlesbian washed fried green tomatoes. But I mean, to speak to like why it hits, I mean, number one, I don't know how anything hits in it because there's so many things. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, people love reality. They love competition. And then they love, it's like people from all over the place, mm-hmm. you know, like Chi-Chi Devane is like, she's from Louisiana. There's like people from all of, BB is from Cameroon. Like there's so many people on it and there's just so many experiences. And I feel like people just like love a sort of slice of experience these days. And I think that's why it's doing so well. It's not like this projection of queerness. Mm-hmm. It's queerness. Like there's no steps in between, you know, and we can have conversations about what the word queerness means and what, you know, all these things. But that's why people watch it, because then you can have conversations.
And
I think.
Going back to you had a show.
I did, yeah.
Yeah.
I still have it. I don't know. it's in one of those weird purgatories.
Air.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Was there anything that you feel like maybe you've now taken away from Drag Race that makes you think, oh, I wish I could do this on TV?
I mean, I wish I could do anything on TV. Yeah. That's basically what it is. It's like, you know, be my authentic self and be on TV, which I think is something, you know, that I've been trying to do. I was also on a TV show called Adam Ruins Everything, and I played Adam's sister. And actually, RuPaul talked about me on her podcast with him, so RuPaul knows who I am and my name was a joke. And Adam was like, it's not, it's real, and she has a great bit about it. So RuPaul knows who I am and might follow me on Twitter, which is fantastic.
Well,
but
you know what? Ru, come into the studio. We'll bring you back.
I'll
tweet you
it
and
out.
Ru.
Yeah, exactly. We'll finally meet. It'll be an adorable meet cute. But yeah, I mean, I think just still doing that, like, you know, talking about the things you want to talk about, being the person you want to be, and not hiding any of that.
Where do you think queer TV cinema needs to go? It's weird. Last year we had this big moment with sort of Moonlight, and it felt different with the Oscars.
Yes.
And now this year, it's funny that you have a big movie like Call Me By Your Name,
but it
almost feels sort of like, it's still nominated for Best Picture, and people are talking about it, but almost in a way it feels not landmark. It feels just like another movie that you've seen.
Why do you think that is?
I think part of it is because it's just a romantic story.
Yeah.
It's set in the 80s, but it also doesn't deal with AIDS or anything.
I know.
You know, it's like people watch it, and I think straight Academy voters see it, and they're like, it doesn't feel like it's giving me like what I think I need from like a queer story. It's not giving me struggle.
Yeah. Nobody dies. So
yeah.
You
know?
Why would you? Yeah, exactly.
And it's just this lovely, beautiful, romantic film, but it's just sort of like, well, what do we do with that?
Yeah. My biggest qualm with that movie is there's no queer sex in it. I mean, that's not to say there's none, because, I mean, there's very much like making out and stuff like that and a couple things. But I loved that movie. I loved watching it. And also it's like, you know, two straight guys playing the parts, which like, good for them, you know. I also feel kind of like we skipped over some weird moment, like where we went from there's like one gay movie every like 5 years, and then we went to like, oh, hot guys are playing gay, hot, you know, like it went from being like good for them to they're hot, and now we're just like, wait, what? Hang on, but slow down a second.
Yeah, we sort of like Moonlight was at least like, oh, finally we're seeing like a black queer story on screen, and then Call Me By Your Name has sort of gotten to the zeitgeist just by everyone on social media is hot for Timothée Chalamet and Armie Hammer.
It's shocking to me. And I think, you know, I would be fine if there wasn't any, well, I wouldn't be fine if there wasn't any gay sex. I really wanted some gay sex anyway. But like the fact that there's like straight sex in the movie.
Yeah.
Is like, wait a minute, what? And it's like objectifying a woman and blah, whatever. But what I would like to see in, you know, queer cinema specifically, because I don't know about TV. TV has so many more opportunities, but it's just like, what if there's just a movie about people who are queer?
Yeah.
Period. Like, full stop. It's just their life and what their life is like, you know.
Well, The Shape of Water, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Let a gay guy fuck that fish.
This is a podcast, but I am doing the egg. This is my favorite Shape of Water thing. Yeah, I mean, just like, what if
or
it's...
Or like the Post, but, you know, like, it's about The Advocate instead of The Washington Post.
Yes. Or Wonder Woman.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Wonder Woman. Yeah. You know, just like literally anything. That's what I would love to see. There's so many opportunities that, like, I just see them not being taken. But at the same time, I feel like it's happening because queer cinema is moving to where, like, more queer people are behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Not just behind the camera, but behind the scenes. Like, producing and choosing and all those things. It actually has to be, like, a sort of grassroots thing where, like, everybody moves slowly up and seeps upward to making the decisions of what movies get made, you know.
Yeah.
So,
and then we can have hot gay actors on TV.
Yes.
Instead of
yes. And but I ooh, speaking of that though, did you watch the show Mindhunter?
I watched the first episode and I need to keep going. I love Jonathan Groff.
Yes. I just want to make a shout out to him because I think, and I don't know how we would find this on the internet, but I think he's like the only actor to come out as gay, then be the lead in a gay show as a gay man, and then get another show and be the lead who is straight and has tons of straight sex scenes.
Yeah.
I think he might be the first person to do that.
No, yeah. I'm thinking about that.
To like be like, I am out. And
I'm,
then
I'm
be like,
out
now
and I'm in a gay
I'm
show.
I'm leading a gay show. It is the gayest gay show. And then now I'm not on that show. And now I'm on a serial killer hunter drama. I'm straight and I'm having very straight sex. On multiple episodes.
Jonathan Groff is the future.
Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you for your service.
Rhea, tell people where they can find you online, where they can find your comedy.
Perfect.
What cities you're traipsing to.
So many cities am I about to traipse within. I'm, you know, on Twitter and Instagram, just Rhea Butcher, at Rhea Butcher. It's R-H-E-A-B-U-T-C-H-E-R. It is a real name, not made up. And then I'm also going on tour this spring. I'm going to be in all kinds of places. Baltimore, Brooklyn, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, Cincinnati, Grand Rapids, Fort Wayne, Indiana, Indianapolis, Indiana, St. Louis, Missouri, and Kansas City, Missouri. And you can buy my most recent release that is a co-release with my wife, Cameron Esposito, called Back to Back, which is on iTunes right now. It was number one for like 5 weeks straight.
All right.
First queer married comedy duo album.
Listen, we love a chart position.
Oh, yeah. I love my charts. Our chart. Yeah. R.I.P.
Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Ira. This is wonderful. And good luck on your quest at Drag Race Gold.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'll see you on the charts.
May the best woman win. Thanks again to Kara and Lewis for joining me and to my guest, Rhea Butcher. That's it for Keep It. I'll see you next week.
I feel like everyone's confused because we asked for equal pay and you people are out here giving us some equal dumb bullshit. Like, nobody wants your equal snack foods.